This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
I'm actually starting with the housing first stuff, right?
Go for it.
All right. So
you could say first, housing first. Or you could say housing first.
All right, 3, 2.
First.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 Cogo. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by managing editor Andrew Keats. What's up, Andy?
Not much, man. How are you?
Well, thank you. And fellow managing editor Andrea Lopez Villafana. What is up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis.
Coming up on the show this week, the County Board of Supervisors voted this week to approve loans to help the city of San Diego buy 3 hotels and an apartment building to house homeless San Diegans. But it was not without controversy. We'll explain the arguments swirling around the once wonky policy debate over housing first and why it has become a major political wedge issue in San Diego. Finally, KPBS reporter Andrew Bowen is going to join us to talk about his new podcast about the history of freeways in San Diego. That's all coming up. Stay with us.
But first, our North County reporter, Tigas Lane, is covering the issues affecting North County residents, like homelessness, housing, and public health. We launched this campaign a year ago thanks to generous seed funding from the Leech Tag Foundation and donor Jack Raymond. You can give now to support that effort and double your impact as Jack Raymond is offering a generous match. Give now at vosd.org/ncountynews. Again, that's vosd.org/ncountynews. Thank you for your support.
This week, the County Board of Supervisors voted 3-1 to approve a plan to help finance new purchases that the city of San Diego wants to do of 3 hotels and an apartment building, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they want to convert the rooms in those buildings into rooms for permanent supportive housing for homeless people, right?
That's right.
And so that happened. They voted for it. Republican Joel Anderson on the County Board of Supervisors was in favor of it, which gave them the necessary 3 votes to do it. But opposed was County Supervisor Jim Desmond. And his sort of statements about it seemed to line up rather well with two other Republicans in town, Bill Wells, Republican mayor of El Cajon, and Richard Bailey, the mayor of Coronado, who all panned this and what they called housing first. So housing first is a discussion and an idea that we have talked about for a decade. And now it's become something of a fierce debate. So let's listen first to, this is Richard Bailey explaining his concern about this purchase and about housing first to KUSI. This is the mayor of Coronado.
The state of California even prohibits counties and cities that are taking advantage of this funding from putting requirements on the individuals that are utilizing this program. So you can't require someone to be sober for using this program. You can offer them treatment services, but you can't mandate that they actually take part in those treatment services while they're part of this program and receiving this housing. And I think unless you couple those two, combined with strong, consistent enforcement of quality of life issues, such as not blocking the sidewalks with 10 encampments and enforcing against the use of drugs publicly on our, you know, in our parks, right, and on our sidewalks, you're not going to have the desired results.
So the state program he's talking about is Project Home Key. This is a big pot of money, $36 million identified for San Diego in particular, to set aside and allow grants and other financing to allow these cities to purchase these buildings, turn them into rooms and places where people can stay. We were actually on the forefront of this several years ago. Mayor Kevin Faulkner, former mayor of the city of San Diego, was one of the first to take advantage of these types of funds that the state made available to purchase 2 hotels that we've done a lot of reporting about. about a conflict of interest that occurred in the purchase of one of them, and in just some of the long-term challenges that they had staffing and safety in those hotels, right?
Got it.
And so it wasn't really a controversial initiative or investment until now. And again, remember the former mayor, Kevin Faulkner, a Republican himself, was on the forefront of it. And so now it's starting to evolve into a wedge issue. So here was Jim Desmond making something of a very similar point to his counterpart, Bailey.
You know, it wasn't so much the price tag, which was ridiculous, but it was the fact that, you know, okay, we need to get homeless into housing, but we have to provide or require treatment. We have to require that they get clean and sober. We have to, you know, the taxpayer is just giving and giving, and there's no accountability, you know, for the homeless person to get help or treatment. And I think that's the root cause. That's what we really need to focus on.
So very similar point. You shouldn't give people places to live until they commit to being sober or are sober. It's a little squishy on where they draw that line. But help us understand. Give me a little history. You did this earlier. Do it for our people. What we're talking about here with this Housing First debate and how it's evolved.
So during the Obama administration, the Housing and Urban Development Department, the HUD, changed its requirements for funding to cities and states for these sorts of programs, and they adopted a Housing First program that sort of supplanted what had been the previous model, transitional housing. Transitional housing is, you know, we could spend all day debating the lines between these things, but transitional housing is largely what Bailey and Desmond are describing here. Don't just give people homes with, you know, right off the bat. Force them to join some sort of treatment program and transition them into housing. Transition them from being on the streets into some programs and services, perhaps with some temporary housing solutions in there, maybe shelter or something, and then transition them into housing. The shift was the biggest problem is to stabilize these people's situations by getting them into a home, and then you can provide them services. So one thing you'll often hear defenders of Housing First say is, hey, it's right there in the name, Housing First. That doesn't mean housing only. We're not opposed to services. What we are opposed to is conditioning housing on the acceptance of services, because people need to be in housing first before that you can start treating it. That's the debate. And it's been going on for a long time. It's been going on for a very long time.
Yeah. So that there was this idea like we weren't doing transitional housing. We had really switched. We were only going to get somebody off the street if they had a permanent place to be. Right. Yeah.
And that was like the debate that like the Faulkner administration lived with a lot, was activists hitting him for, you know, while publicly committing to Housing First, that there would still be certain things that looked like or smelled like transitional housing, or like there wasn't a full commitment to that shift, and that people were angry about it. And so some, you know, sort of like the navigation center downtown, like, hey, you're spending a lot of money, and this is not a Housing First use of money.
Or the tents they put up, the giant tents called bridge shelters, right?
Yes. And you know, there was like a hotel that they tried to buy in sort of on the border between the city and Imperial Beach, that was going to be a program that would be part of it for housing.
Yeah, the SAFE program. It was like, yeah, instead of going to jail, you could go there,
yeah,
and work things. And
so
out.
So activists were jumping on all of these things and saying like, this is not Housing First. You're you know, I think it would be fair to say that like, Housing First is like a first principle is even if you, before you get to the housing, is like, don't have shelters that require you to be sober to go into them. So you still see those in North County. People have these, there's controversy around whether there are enough low barrier shelters that you can just go into. That is sort of in keeping with a Housing First principle. Don't put up obstacles to people who are doing anything towards getting off the street. help stabilize them first, and then you can start to do this other stuff.
Yeah, that's the heart of the debate, right?
Yes.
At the core is this contention about whether you need to get off the streets before you can even start to stabilize your life that way. You need to get into a stable shelter mm-hmm. of some kind of home, and then you'll be able to fix these other things versus you don't deserve that or shouldn't get that. You should graduate to that only after you've achieved sobriety and mental health stability.
Proved a commitment, you know, provided some sort of return on the resources that have been allocated to you. Yeah, exactly. There's a moralizing component of the transitional housing model, I would say. And this was like, this debate was like, although I say this has been happening for a long time, it was like happening in like the wonkiest circles, right? Like there were like actual providers and service providers who were had built a business model and had been working with homeless people for years who weren't exactly excited about shifting towards housing first in the early days. And so there was a whole debate about, okay, well, we've said we're doing housing first now, but are we doing housing first? Are some of these providers still sort of clinging to the practices that really more resemble transitional housing than resemble housing first? How much can we really say we've demonstrated this commitment? And even that sort of had a very reminiscent, though slightly different, echo a couple weeks ago. Rachel Lang, the mayor's communications director, in responding to criticism of Housing First, said, look, we're not doing Housing First because we haven't provided anywhere near enough housing to meaningfully claim that we're pursuing a Housing First strategy. If we don't have enough housing to put people in, then it doesn't make sense to claim that we're even doing Housing First. Now that's getting into some sort of like quibbling with the terminology and sort of ducking the essence of the debate, I think. But
well, that was the kind of thing that would come up a lot. People would be like, you need to do an investigation about Housing First. It's obviously caused all these problems. It's not working.
Yeah.
And I would always be like, well, they're building a ton of shelters. Like they've been putting up a ton of these, you know, the library they converted to a shelter, the Golden Hall they converted to a shelter for a while, the convention center, the tent they put up in Midway. Like they're not foregoing those things in favor of only doing permanent housing for people. And so I was always like, well, why is this even considered a debate? Because they're clearly not doing it. Now, it's not the same as saying that it's not working because we're clearly not doing it, but just because they couldn't create that much housing and there had to be something done in the meantime.
Yeah, there's definitely an unsatisfying debate happening here when like you can't even agree whether we've put the pieces in place to see if it's successful or not. I mean, the Faulkner administration, definitely, I remember them explicitly saying, sure, like housing first, absolutely, but it takes years, decades, millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to build the amount of housing we're going to need. So what do we do in the meantime? And that was when you started hearing their proposal of dramatically increasing the amount of shelter space and combining that with some targeted enforcement that essentially pushes people into shelters once you've provided them. And that like dynamic continues to be the operating philosophy of the city of San Diego. The mayoral administration has changed from the Faulkner administration to the Gloria administration. But the housing is the way out of this, but it's going to take a long time and we don't have near enough of it. So in the meantime, expand shelters and use enforcement to get them into shelters perhaps people could quibble with how much that is their operating philosophy, but that seems to me to be their operating philosophy.
There's this also this desire to blame somebody for homelessness right now.
Yeah.
And the clear target of this is, well, this is liberal California and this is liberal San Diego, liberal San Francisco, liberal LA that have created this circumstance. And in part because of Housing First, they are to blame for what has happened in the streets, that what we see in the streets is a result, not a circumstance that they're dealing with, but a result of their decisions to embrace this approach, right? Yeah. And I think that there's always this look for who's to blame, right? On the left, they look and they say, well, it's the landlords. or it's the government, but it's the government's inability to let housing be built, right?
Yeah.
You look at
the structure of the economy in general, that wages are too low.
Right.
Right.
And so there's always a push to figure out who's to blame, and in this case it fits nicely that their regular villain is the one to blame on this one, which is local government led by Democrats.
Yeah, although it would be fair to point out that HUD under Ben Carson and Donald Trump maintained its commitment to Housing First as a condition for federal housing dollars on homelessness.
Right.
I think the other thing that's happening here that we're seeing play out with, you know, the stunning similarity between statements made by Jim Desmond, made by Richard Bailey, Bill Wells in a press release. Even this wasn't actually timed with this, but Tiggis Lane, our North County reporter, wrote a story about the Escondido mayor, Dane White, who was formerly homeless. He shared his story having done that, and he made some comments about his perspective on how to solve homelessness as a result of what he lived through. And he was really reflective of the same thoughts that these other leaders were saying. And I think
that you need to do treatment and then you can get into
stable. There's a lot of buzzwords that you hear that like root cause, you know, that the root cause is not lack of housing or lack of wages. The root cause is mental illness or addiction. That like if you hear that, that's an argument against Housing First for transitional housing.
And his own story was that of, you know, addiction and homelessness. And I think,
although it is true that he was placed into housing when he got treatment for his addiction.
Yes.
So he's sort of his story does in some ways reinforce the importance of housing and stabilizing a situation.
Yeah, I guess that's where I still don't understand their point. Like, at what point do you have to make the commitment?
And that was the period we were in during these debates in like 2014 and 2015, where you had people saying like, "We are doing Housing First," and there were like, you know, absolutists who were saying like, "No, that looks like transitional housing to me."
You're still making them do.
You're still making them do. You know, and that's it does get unproductive and sort of like an argument about defining terms at a certain point. There is some gray space in between these things. But the other thing that seems to be happening here to me is the Faulkner administration was the defining figure in what conservative Republicans in San Diego believed for a while. He was the mayor of San Diego. He was by far the highest profile Republican in town. His position was, yes, Housing First. That is true. All the research is true. You know, he wouldn't debate the studies. He wouldn't claim that the literature was wrong. He wouldn't call you, misguided, nerdy California egghead liberals. He accepted the premise that Housing First was the solution. He just said, in the meantime, we must deal with this situation on the streets, and the way to do that is with shelter and enforcement. And like, as I said before, that position has basically been occupied now by Todd Gloria, the most prominent Democrat in town. The mayor's office has essentially maintained that position. You could pick out some ways they may be different, but the city of San Diego's policy on homelessness hasn't changed in the last few years, as far as I can tell, really. Mm-hmm. And so it's pushed everything to the right. And so the response now from, you know, people like Bill Wells, Jim Desmond, Richard Bailey can't be the same thing that the Democratic mayor is pursuing. It's now housing is not just the primary problem. It's not part of the solution. It is misguided to buy these hotels and provide housing because you're not going to do the right thing with it. You're just going to give it to people without conditions. Like it will actually hurt. You know, the it's gone from you can't just focus on housing to let's not even talk about housing.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that there's an interesting thing going on as well with the discussion about housing, because if you acknowledge that housing at all, the housing market in general, mm-hmm. housing supply in general is part of the problem, you have to accept a level of responsibility depending on your own situation, whether you're somebody who enforces the restrictions on building housing or whether you're just a person who has a nice house, right? It just, it starts to implicate everybody as part of the problem. And look at somebody like Richard Bailey, the mayor of Coronado. He maintains he's part of the government of Coronado, which has a very restrictive policy on new housing, right? Like, it's not allowed in Coronado broadly, right?
Yeah.
And so he, as a, you know, he has to square that with his worldview, which is essentially at the heart, like, Republicans say, well, we're free market people, right? We believe in the market. The government should stay out. Except in his case, in his part of the county, you're not allowed, the government does not allow you to use your property to build things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to square that, housing cannot be part of the solution, right? Like, you can't really make housing part of the solution if your entire approach to governance is that it's not allowed.
Conceding the one puts you in an unfavorable position in this ongoing argument on the other side.
Yeah, you can't say, like, housing first, but your city doesn't build much housing.
right.
And so then homelessness de facto has to be something else, something wrong with the people, or morally wrong, or a failing that they are, again, with something we've always we're dealing with, which is these are people who have fallen, and they need to be redeemed, but they have to go through almost a religious process to get to something that they can now deserve redemption and get into a house, right? Or get into a place to live. And I think that clashes with the other side that says, well, no, you need to get them all off the street. And the criticism to them is like, well, can you satisfy that demand? We can't build those many that many homes that rapidly. We can't provide wraparound services for that many people that rapidly. And so what are we doing? Like, what's the plan? What's the emergency plan for all the people on the streets while this happens?
Yeah.
And is it just to let them be? And I think those two worldviews, they're both problematic, but they're starting to clash in more like clear partisan lines right now.
Yeah. There's this other thing going on that's just interesting as somebody who's observed these sorts of debates for a long time, which is the hotel acquisition strategy was appealing broadly to conservatives, I think, in a way that might have been like controversial among progressives 10 years ago, in that it bypassed the affordable housing industry.
Right.
Right. An affordable housing industry that conservatives had been really opposed to funding on the grounds that it took too long to build the housing. It was too expensive to build the housing. It provided too few units at too great a cost for the industries or markets that you taxed to fund it, and that you shouldn't do it, right? This is like a completely different thing, where it's like you get the housing units in a couple months as opposed to 4 or 5 years. You don't have to stack up all these complicated funding structures to do it. And it's cheaper on a per door basis. Now you have people still being outraged that it's like $450,000 a hotel room.
But that's better than 750.
Even though that's better than what the alternative of building affordable housing, to say nothing of the time the value of time of getting it in a couple months. And so, like, I think you would have if everybody was staying true to the principles outlined 10 years ago, and keeping in mind that these are actually different people in a lot of cases, it's I'm assigning people to the roles of their predecessors. But if the political lines had stayed the same, we should buy hotels and transition them into places for people to live as housing while we treat them. That would have been the conservative alternative. And in fact, it was under Mayor Faulkner. It would have been the conservative alternative to the raise the linkage fee, assess the value on new commercial development based on the fact that there are jobs there and that some of those will be low wage, and then we'll use that as a carrot to attract other funding sources, and then we can give that to nonprofit developers who will build it over a 5-year period. And at the end of that, we'll have 30 units.
10 people will get, yeah.
That was the thing that used to make conservatives angry. And this is like the alternative to that. And it's now it's still like, no, it's bad.
Yeah.
Giving them the housing at any price is bad because it's the wrong solution. And like that is a real tectonic shift in this debate over a 10-year period.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. Now, Andrea, your team and you produced this week a couple of compelling stories about people actually trying to navigate this world, or who did navigate. In this case, the Escondido mayor, Dane White. So tell us a little bit about that story that Tigas did and what you pulled from it.
So his story, from a very young age, he told Tigas he struggled a lot and he had a lot of problems with his family. And he, you know, was living with his parents and he kept getting in trouble. And he moved with his grandparent. And that was a point where he started getting into more trouble. And eventually he became homeless. And he was very young. He was a teenager when this happened. And he ended up going down a spiral where a lot of young people do when they're, you know, kicked out of a family member's home, where you're homeless, but you're couch surfing, right? You're not homeless, maybe living on the street, but you're couch surfing. And he ended up finding an apartment with a friend and kind of started falling into drugs and addiction from there. And then just kind of spiraling from that position to a point where he was on the street and living behind a 7-Eleven.
Yeah, in Escondido.
In Escondido, where he grew up.
And where he's now mayor.
Yeah.
And so that we hear often about how hard it is for people to get out of these situations and move up. And now here's somebody who moved up, not only into a stable situation, but moved on. Was there a moment that he described that started to click or it worked? And it was what he described was treatment, right? It was a stable place to live and treatment.
Yeah, he focuses more on the treatment than the stable place to live.
Yeah.
But focusing on the treatment, he says that was the root cause of his homelessness. And I think that's where these sides are talking past each other a bit. It's like, yes, people would disagree and say, no, the root cause of your homelessness was that you didn't have a home.
Yeah.
And lots of people have homes and are maintain long-running addictions for weeks or months or years. Often that's in different places where housing is cheaper, and so it's easier to maintain your living situation even in the course of an addiction. But what's interesting about him, he's willing to spend money on the problem.
Yeah.
He says we should increase the amount of money we spend on services and treatment. And I don't know that people would necessarily turn that down. What's in, you know, like, again, Housing First provides room for ample treatment options, whether it's mental health or addiction. Where something changed this week was we should not spend money on housing. This is counterproductive. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I didn't hear from him in that article that he is going quite that far.
Yeah.
He's more of just saying the root cause of my homelessness was my addiction.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of shaping my take on his view on what our city should do.
Yeah.
So then you did a piece this week as well on a couple you've been following. Tell us about them.
This couple, Tammy and William, they became homeless after the pandemic. Will's job where he worked had shut down. He had some disability issues, but they were getting by on him just picking up odd jobs in construction. He also worked for Amazon. They had to leave the apartment that they rented in El Cajon, and they didn't have enough money saved up because of their financial situation to, you know, pay the deposit, move in somewhere new. So they decided, okay, we'll live in our car, kind of see what we can save up and maybe go from there. It turned out to be a much more chaotic situation because while he was at work, Tammy would have to sit in the car and, you know, she became increasingly worried. Well, what if the car got towed, right? So there's all these thoughts going through her mind, anxiety about just kind of sitting in a car all day because they have two dogs and she has a mental, or she has a health condition where she can't drive. She gets seizures. So eventually she sought out the safe parking lot program that the county just opened, run by nonprofit Dreams for Change. They signed up. It was a few, you know, months of relief to just have a safe place to park at night because that's how these safe lots operate, right? They open up. Some of them offer a variety of different services, but for the most part, if you live in your car, you can park there at night without having to worry about, you know, people coming up to your car and asking you to move along. So they were there for a couple months, but just having to navigate a system of like basic things, trying to get funding from the county to pay for her car repairs, navigating like all these different programs, trying to work with the staff, trying just to get any kind of assistance to get into stable housing, because that's what she wanted. She just wanted a little bit of time to breathe while she was at that parking lot and then move to some sort of to housing, back to an apartment. That has not happened. They've been homeless. Next week will be a year. And, you know, they were in a position where they were working. They could have easily just had a couple months to get back on their feet, but there is no housing to move them into.
And then the actual nightmare scenario was their car, right?
Their car.
They were, when you're living in your car needs to work.
Yeah, your car needs to work. Basically, when I met them, their car had gotten really bad to the point where like they turned it on just to show me how bad it was and made like this terrible sound. All the people, we were outside of Starbucks and all the people around us like looked at us like, what's going on here? And so she was adamant, like at any point, this car is going to break down and we are going to be on the street. Like how much vulnerable does a person have to get some sort of service? And that's what happened. A couple of days after I met her, she texted me and their car broke down and there was basically nothing that they were, you know, could do. So they had to sleep in a tent. Eventually, Dreams for Change and the county helped them to move into a motel, just temporary, while their car is getting fixed. But again, once their car gets fixed, they'll go back to living in their car.
I think what's interesting about your story was just all the steps. And every step you go down the ladder of toward actual street homelessness, it seems like getting back up the ladder is like twice as hard, right? That's what I keep getting out of all of these stories we do. This is what the 10th of these stories we've done where somebody's fallen down all the way and climbing back up is just really hard. And that's what's the moral and the theme throughout all of these. And no better one than this to express, like to get stability, you have to have a job. To have a job, you have to have stability. And to have a job that pays enough to get into a home, you have to be able to save money. But then you start racking up bills and parking tickets and repair problems. And the worse it gets for you, the harder it gets to get out. It's just a brutal vortex, it feels like.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and their problem started even before they became homeless, right? They were having issues with a landlord, asking for their landlord to fix their apartment. You know, that turned out to be big chaos for them. And they had to leave that apartment. Then they're living in their car. The registration's paid for, but it didn't pass a smog check. You know, so she's applying for these programs. And it just keeps spiraling from there. The tags are going to be expired. She's not going to be eligible for this program anymore. She just can't get someone to help her pay for the car repairs. And also, because they live in their car, they need somewhere to stay just a couple days while the car is getting repaired. So it's just like constantly. Then finally, you're on the street, you're sleeping in a tent with your dogs. And, you know, okay, where do we go from here, right? We're in a worse situation. We don't even have a car where, you know, her partner can get to work anymore. So now he's not even working.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that all of the problems that they encountered are immensely frustrating for them, and like you can see how hard it was. Also, I think the amount of administrative perfection it would require to assume that no one utilizing these programs would ever encounter these sorts of hiccups is unrealistic, and that the margins on any like just squeaking by are so thin, and that the sort of like rounding errors of problems in, you know, the strings tied to this state program for car repairs. The expiration dates on these things that are built in for like basic funding allocation reasons, or the hours on the safe parking site. Now you could probably just get rid of the hours, but you know, when they weren't being able to connect with their case manager, all of these things were like, life is complicated for everyone, and I see these sorts of problems being basically inevitable. But when they come to you when you have no room to spare, mm-hmm. none, you can't just like stomach that one little hiccup, and the next thing you know, you're in a tent, is what's so grim about it. I mean, like that it requires complete paperwork perfection, no hiccups, choosing the right shop the first time you get an estimate.
Yeah.
Like it's just, you know,
you don't do that when you're,
there's thousands. Yeah, exactly. I don't do that.
You just go to like, any shop.
Right. It's like, yeah, exactly. I don't want to draw an analogy because no scenario I can come up with carries the stakes of the one that we have here. But like in any situation where you have no margin for error, well, guess what? Things still go wrong. And you know, that's when you have problems.
I think that's what gets me too about this whole thing. Again, we get this, there is so much diversity of what people are experiencing there. Obviously, there's a lot of drug use. There's a lot of mental health crises occurring everywhere. But it's not like there's a clear group of them and then a clear group of folks like this that have fallen into hard times. The melting between those two worlds is extreme, right? Like there's a very good chance that if they have to spend too long in a tent, then they are going to have to, you know, they're going to have some trauma counseling pretty soon as well, or they're going to turn to ways to make it feel better, right? If somebody offers you a pill that's going to make you feel less cold, that might be attractive at some point. And things like that will melt together. It's just not easy. And you can't just look at the crisis and say, like, those are bad people who have fallen. And there's maybe a few good ones. We can get them out of it. But the rest, you know, have to pay out some kind of price. It's not as clean as everybody, I think, or those folks would want it to be. So what do we know? They're just waiting to find out if there's a path to some sort of more permanent housing.
Yeah. So they are currently still at the motel that they were set up at, and they're waiting for their car to be repaired. But, you know, kind of like she said, with what I ended my story with, is it's nice, but it's only temporary, and they don't have any sort of housing lined up after that. So they'll likely go back to living in their vehicle. Likely will have to go back to that parking lot. But yeah, there's no happy ending here.
We are going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
We are now joined in the great Voice of San Diego podcast studio by KPBS reporter Andrew Bowen, making his second appearance on the show. First yeah. in the studio, though.
Yes, last time we were remote. So.
Yes. Was that pandemic era?
It was like July 2021. So I was recording from my home. Yeah.
Pseudo pandemic. Yeah.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Well, we are here. You're here now because you have a fantastic project, program,
new podcast. It's called the podcast.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a podcast. I don't know if you
like this thing yeah. that we're on right now.
It's a show.
Now.
It's yeah. a new show you have show. Called Freeway Exit.
Yeah.
Right. It is a history of the creation and the protests against and the movement for and the funding of freeways in San Diego.
Mm-hmm. Past, present, and future. Past, yeah, that's present. That's sort of the tagline is, you know, there's a lot of forgotten history about our freeways. Most of us have come to San Diego after they were already built. And we kind of take for granted that a lot of those spaces used to be something else before those, well, all of them used to be something before they were built. But we don't know that history. And freeways are just at the center of so much of our political debates in San Diego around transportation and climate action and housing. So it just seemed like a real ripe topic for something, you know, a bit longer form than what we're used to from KPBS.
Yeah, we're also sort of getting into an era where, like, the creation of the freeways was long enough ago that even the older people in your life probably don't remember a time without them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas, like, you know, in the 70s or 80s, there were people for whom the creation of a freeway was fresh. San Diego without them was in their memory bank, right? You know, there are fewer and fewer people around for whom that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like the freeways, I mean, the first freeway in San Diego, and this is like right in episode one, the first freeway that ever came to San Diego was the 163. At the time, it was called the Cabrillo Parkway. And it started basically where more or less where the 8 intersects the 163 now. And it went down through Balboa Park to downtown. And so that was 1948. 1908 when it was built. But then it wasn't until the mid-50s, and we talk about this in episode two, after the passage of the Interstate and Defense Highways Act, and this huge infusion of federal spending for freeways across the entire country, when we really start to see the freeway in San Diego take off and shape how our city is actually built.
Yeah. So the 163, I mean, the 163 is fascinating because it's part of a history of what we've done with freeways. It's also a part of a history of like what we've done to Balboa Park, right? Like for a place that calls that its crown jewel.
Yes.
I don't know that our actions are especially consistent with the moniker.
Yeah.
Let's put a freeway.
There aren't many crown jewels that are cut up by a freeway.
Yeah.
That are in the flight path.
Right.
that have a landfill in them.
Yeah.
That are occupied with a bus maintenance yard or a, you know, city truck maintenance yard. Mm-hmm. Right. There's a lot of stuff that is like generally considered unwanted, like not in my backyard stuff.
Yes.
That somehow ended up directly in the center of our supposed crown jewel.
It's a crown jewel, but with character.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of my early memories in San Diego was hiking on the Bridal Trail when a friend of mine was visiting. And for anyone who doesn't know, the Bridal Trail goes right next to the freeway. It runs like right parallel to the freeway. And it's a really, just the contrast between the beautiful setting, the walls of the canyon, and, you know, right now they're all covered in wildflowers. Mm-hmm. And the contrast between that and the feeling that you get just like standing right next to all of that traffic and the noise, just like not even being able to hear yourself think. I remember hiking that trail with friends and thinking, okay, I guess this is how San Diego does parks. and then, you know, I think a lot of us in San Diego have had that moment where we see the pictures of Cabrillo Canyon before the freeway was built, with the lily pond under the Cabrillo Bridge. And, you know, there is, I think, for a lot of us, a sense of loss of what the park used to be before so much of that space was taken over by cars.
And yet you have this tidbit in the show. What was the vote in favor of the creation of the Cabrillo Freeway?
Yeah, it was in 1941. So people may know that there's a part of the city charter that requires a public vote for any dedication of any part of Balboa Park that's not parkland. So in order to give Caltrans, at the time they were called the California Division of Highways, in order to give them that space and to build the freeway, there had to be a public vote. And that happened in 1941, and it passed with 89% of the vote.
89%.
89% of San Diego voters said, yes, let's put a freeway through Balboa Park.
Could you think of something that could get 89% of the vote in San Diego right now?
No, literally nothing. No, nothing in my mind could I think of that many people would agree on. But, you know, and we talk about this in the podcast, like, there was a real sense of that freeways were progress, that this is the future. And there, you know, I mean, at the time, this was before World War II, but, you know, in the aftermath and after the freeway was built, people had a lot of disposable income. They were buying cars in greater numbers. Mm-hmm. There was a greater appetite for people to have their own homes, not live in, you know, close quarters anymore. So that's, you know, why we ended up with all the suburban sprawl that we had here. And so, it's pretty crazy to think that, and you know, if you were to ask someone if we were to imagine an alternate universe where the freeway was not built through Balboa Park and we were to have to hold that vote again today, how many people do you think would vote for it? I mean, I have no idea, but I know it's not 89%.
No. I mean, one of the things that struck me in that episode is you talk about there was like a common vision that this would be good for the growth of San Diego. This would be part of it becoming a bigger city, allowing it to punch alongside LA and San Francisco. We spend a lot of time debating about like whether there are good, like whether one idea or another is a good way to do that. But even before we get to the idea of like litigating any specific proposal, I don't think there's any shared vision now that we want to do that. I think there's like a group of people who would like San Diego to be bigger and to grow, to pursue more economic opportunity. But then there's like as much a group of people who are like, no, what we should do is stay like this, stay as we are, or maybe even move backwards some, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like, that's one of the sort of historical juxtapositions that I drew out of the show is like, oh, there was a time where there was a shared vision that San Diego could be bigger and more.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't tell you like which side has the majority.
I think that
it would take a lot of very sophisticated polling to figure out, you know, how many people in San Diego want the city to grow and how many don't. But I think it doesn't really matter what people think because the city is growing and it will continue to grow and there's nothing that we can do to stop it. Mm-hmm. But bringing this back to freeways, I mean, the real conversation we have to ask ourselves to have in San Diego is, as we grow, are we going to continue to invest in the freeway? Mm-hmm. And given all of the commitments that we've made around climate change and reducing our dependence on cars, is there an alternative where, you know, we can see a future where fewer people are driving, people live closer to work, live closer to all of the amenities that they need day to day, and don't need to drive on the freeways as often? Mm-hmm. Or if they do drive on the freeways, it's for a much shorter distance. Mm-hmm. And if that's the future that we can see, like, what do the freeways look like? Mm-hmm. How much space is left over? You know, the congestion that we experience, it's really only for a couple hours each day. Outside of that, the freeways are functioning very well at moving a lot of people very fast. But during those peak hours when there's a lot of demand to use the freeways all at the same time, that's when you experience congestion. And you know, people from Sandag will tell you, if we can reduce the number of cars on the freeways during peak hours by about 10%, we can get speeds back to normal. So if there is a future where we have excess capacity on our freeways, then what do we do with that excess capacity? Do we just keep it like a freeway because that's the best use of that public land? Mm-hmm. Or is there a future where we can imagine some other type of use for that land?
Well, so you have some proposals that you go through in the show, mm-hmm. that are not specifically, you know, new freeway expansion proposals, but freeway mitigation, freeway decommissioning, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What are some of those ideas that you go through in the show?
Yeah, well, the first one we talk about is decommissioning the 163 through Balboa Park, and this is an idea that circulates on Twitter every now and again. You might have seen at some point this Twitter account that generates images of streets and freeways without cars, you know, pedestrianized mm-hmm. Streets and everything. It's AI image generation. And they did that for the 163, showing this beautiful park with somebody biking and a line of flowers under the Carrillo Bridge. And it really went viral. I think that says, you know, people are interested in imagining that future, even if they can't see it happening anytime soon. The most radical solution to that question, or the most radical answer to that question of what do we do with the excess capacity in this future where people are driving a lot less, the most radical answer is let's decommission a freeway, just completely remove that from the network and do something else with that land. This has been done before. Like, it's not something that is totally out of the question or that there is no roadmap for us to follow. Rochester, New York decommissioned their inner loop freeway. And built a boulevard. In episode 5, which is going to be dropping on Tuesday, so folks should subscribe now and listen to that when it drops. We're talking about
that's freeway exit available on all of your podcast platforms.
Wherever you listen to podcasts,
that's right.
So in San Francisco, after the 1989 earthquake, two freeways in the city were so severely damaged that the city decided it was prohibitively expensive to reconstruct them to a higher mm-hmm. seismic standard. So they decommissioned those freeways and they redeveloped that land. And surprise, surprise, it's been a universally lauded success. We dig into in episode 5 into the concept of traffic evaporation, where when you reduce the capacity of a road network, it doesn't automatically just mean that traffic gets worse and stays that way. People adjust their behaviors according to the capacity that's available to them. Decommissioning is definitely the most radical idea. There are also ideas around lids, freeway lids, which we have one already in City Heights, Terralta Park, which we talk about in episode 4. Mm-hmm. But there's also a proposal to build a lid over I-5 in Barrio Logan, which is arguably one of the most impacted communities in San Diego by freeways. So yeah, those are some of the ideas we talk about. Also
Golden
like
Hill, I live in Golden Hill. There was the
94.
Yeah, there was a robust conversation for a while about a freeway lid over the 94, kind of stitch back together Golden Hill and Sherman Heights, which were at one point one community before before the creation of the 94. There's even been a discussion about the downtown to Bankers Hill freeway caps on that S-curve, part of the S curve. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about freeway lids is that there's a lot of support for them because they're a very elegant and beautiful way to reconnect two sides of a freeway that have been divided. They're also in most cases prohibitively expensive. They can cost up to $1 billion. And there's a program in the bipartisan infrastructure law called Reconnecting Communities, where the U.S. Department of Transportation is giving out grants to local and state governments in order to mitigate some or, you know, repair some of the harms that were done with the freeway boom of the mid-century, particularly in low-income communities of color. And that program has, I think, a little over $1 billion. So if they were to take, if they were to take all that money and dedicate it to one project,
one cap,
yes. So,
nice.
So at the
please
same time,
us, please be us,
right?
Fingers crossed.
I mean, and well, and they actually announced the first round of awards. There was an application for the freeway lid in Barrio Logan, and it was not given funding. Okay. And if you look at the number of projects that applied for that money versus the ones that were actually awarded it. There's just a huge gap. I mean, there's nowhere near enough resources to mitigate all of the damage that was done by freeways, and lids are not a scalable solution.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Andrew Bowen, Freeway Exit, available on all of your favorite platforming devices for podcast and other means of audio listening. Well, great job. It's a really interesting lesson.
Thanks.
People will learn a lot about San Diego and freeways in general.
Thank you.
So Andy and Andrew and their mustaches really got into it here. I'm going to put up a full version of this conversation as its own episode where they get even deeper into this topic, into freeway decommissioning, environmental impacts, the future of transportation, and a spoiler for that last episode of Freeway Exit. That'll come in your feed next week. Keep an eye out. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. And don't forget about that gift match for our North County reporting. We're halfway to our goal and your donation will make a difference. You can give now at vosd.org/ncountynews. That's vosd.org/ncountynews. The link is in the show notes. And I'm also putting up videos for this podcast on a regular basis, so check out full segments and clips on YouTube, and I'm putting out some more on Instagram and TikTok as well, so you can check us out there. Scott Lewis is our CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. Andrew Keats is managing editor. Andre Lopez Villafana is also managing editor. I'm Nate John, producer for the show. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.